it's a great pleasure to be here again, and thank you, Joy, for organizing everything so well. And Joy suggested this title to me, so it is a new talk, this. So it may have a part of a talk you've heard before, but it's essentially a new talk, and it's one I've enjoyed preparing. So does it matter if the Bible is reliable? And I think it does matter, because Christianity and Judaism, they're not sort of ethical beliefs. I mean, they are ethical beliefs, but they're based upon historical events, like for the Jews, the exodus from Egypt, for Christians, the birth, death, and resurrection of Jesus. So they are based on these historical events, and we know about these historical events from the Bible. It's our main source of information. So it does matter if the Bible is reliable. And the Old Testament, for example, I think there are three main options. You can say it's purely fiction, or it's a fictional matrix in which there is some history embedded, or it's got major historical content. I mean, clearly things like the Proverbs of Solomon are not historical, they're proverbs and so on, and the Song of Solomon, but it has a major historical content in the Old Testament. The question is that factual history or not? And then of Jesus, the character of Jesus, we really know from the New Testament. There's very little information about Jesus outside the New Testament, so Tacitus refers to him, Josephus probably refers to him, but our main source of information about Jesus is the New Testament. So again, does it matter if this is reliable? And it does matter if you're a believer, or if you're a non-believer, it matters, because that's where you go to challenge people's believers' belief, as it were. How can we know if the Bible is reliable? So I've looked at a few books on this, and a number of them are just personal convictions. You know, people are arguing it's not reliable or it is reliable. It's largely personal convictions. And so what I want to do with you is to try and look at some evidence, and in particular, right, let's see if this is, I will wave my hand then. Okay, thank you. And I'm going to look at some case studies, just three case studies. And that's the story of Joseph in the Old Testament book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible. And then I'm going to look at the crossing of the River Jordan, which is in the book of Joshua. And I think some years ago I did speak about this miracle, but I'm going to look at it more in terms of the historical basis rather than the miraculous basis. And then I'm going to look at the Last Supper in the New Testament, which is in all four Gospels. And I've chosen these because these are all three topics in which modern scholars do question their historic nature. So first is the story of Joseph, and this is in the book of Genesis, and I'll have to, because my eyesight is not quite good enough for that, I'll stand here, and what I've done is to try and do a summary here. It starts in Genesis chapter 30, where Joseph is born. It ends in Genesis chapter 50, where Joseph dies. So the story of Joseph is major. I hadn't realized just how important it was in the book of Genesis. It occupies about 40% of the book of Genesis. And this is a paraphrase of the story. So Joseph is Jacob's favorite son, although he's not the firstborn. So that's really unusual. So the firstborn was usually the favorite son. In Joseph's case, he was a favorite son. And his brothers were very jealous of him, I think particularly because he was not the firstborn. And so they sold him as a slave for 20 shekels of silver. And I put that in yellow because, if you like, that's a bit of evidence. And we'll come back to that. And then he was taken to Egypt and sold to someone called Potiphar. And Potiphar's wife tried to seduce Joseph. The Bible says she tried to get him into her bed. And Joseph said no to this. And Potiphar's wife then got very angry about this because she'd been rejected. And so she said to her husband, "Joseph tried to seduce me," and he got Joseph thrown in prison. And while Joseph was in prison, Pharaoh's cupbearer was also thrown in prison. He'd fallen out of favor with Pharaoh. And Pharaoh's cupbearer had a dream, which Joseph interpreted. And then a little later, Pharaoh had a dream, which no one could interpret. And so Pharaoh's cupbearer contacted Pharaoh and said, "There's a man in prison here called Joseph, and he's great at interpreting dreams." So he went to interpret this dream, and the interpretation of the dream was that in Egypt there was going to be 7 years of plenty, plentiful harvest, and 7 years of famine. So Pharaoh was delighted to have this interpretation of his dream, and he took Joseph out of prison, and he made Joseph his second in command over all of Egypt. a technical term is called vizier. And then this in fact happened. There were 7 years of plentiful harvest and 7 years of famine that then occurred. So, and then the story goes on, so I'll just stop it there. But this is the Joseph story in outline. Okay, fine. I'll wave my hand, it's probably easier than using this, right? And these are two quotations about Joseph's story by two quite eminent biblical scholars and historians. So this is by Redford in a book called Egypt, Canaan, and Israel in Ancient Times. The Joseph story shows all the hallmarks of a composition rather than a record. And then another historian called Alstom says the Joseph story is not history, just as, for instance, Shakespeare wrote about Richard III, a biblical writer could compose a story about Joseph and his brothers in Egypt. And this was in a book called The History of Ancient Palestine. So Alstom and many scholars don't consider this story history, they consider it an invention in the same way that Shakespeare invented his plays. So, next slide, please. Thank you. And so many scholars do believe the story to be a myth, and they believe it to be a myth for what are actually good reasons, or apparently good reasons. And the first is that it is really inconceivable that an Egyptian pharaoh would appoint a non-Egyptian as his deputy, as his second in command and over all of Egypt. So that's one reason given, which is a very plausible reason. And then the second reason is that this story was written, it seems, about 1,000 years after the supposed events, right? A huge length of time. And so it cannot possibly be accurate. So, and that's another good reason. So you think today, we're living, say, in the year 2000. Think of now writing something that happened in the year 1000, right? And let's imagine you don't have the internet, right? And none of these things. And so how can you possibly write about something which happened 1,000 years ago? And how can that be accurate? So these are good stories. And good reasons for scholars thinking it's a myth. Many evangelicals, and I think I would class myself as that, and a number of people here would as well, they tend to ignore such criticisms. They sort of close their eyes to them, which I think is the wrong approach. So I think what we need to do is to take these seriously and engage with these criticisms and see if, in fact, they are true or not. So the first question is, would an Egyptian pharaoh appoint a foreigner as a deputy? So that's a really good question. So let's look at Joseph and when he might have lived. So if he is historical, let's ask when he lived. And it's something, I just put this up, it's something that I did some work on some time ago in this paper called The Eruption of Santorini and the Data and Historicity of Joseph. And also there's a paper in Geology Today about this. And what we did in this paper was to focus on this 7-year famine in Egypt, because if you look at Egyptian records, and we don't have continuous records in Egypt. We just have records for certain periods of time. If you look at those records, there are records of famine, but they are quite unusual, and they're typically not that unusual. They're typically 1 year in 10, and the reason they're not more common is because Egypt owns its prosperity to the Nile, which flooded every year, and it flooded because of snow melting at the source and everything. And so this was a fairly repeatable event. And so for the Nile not to flood and cause a famine was relatively unusual. So it's about 1 year in 10 this happened. And 2 consecutive years were really rare, the records we have. That would be something like 1 year every 100 years. So thinking of 7 consecutive years really is extremely unusual. And even if you don't take the number 7 literally, maybe it means, quite a reasonably large number, but 7 obviously means more than 3. Let's say 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7. To think of that happening because of the flooding of the Nile failing is almost inconceivable, I think, because the Egyptian records we have, there weren't floods of this length of time at all. There weren't famines of this length of time because of the lack of flooding of the Nile. So we thought of another possible reason for the famine. And also the Bible says that the famine was not only in Egypt, but in neighboring lands as well. So that suggests that this famine had nothing to do with the Nile not flooding. And one reason for famines of several years in duration or more is due to volcanic eruptions. So we have instances, well documented, of volcanic eruptions which cause famine because they emit toxic volcanic gases, and these toxic ashes then fall on the ground and they devastate the crops, basically, and they render the ground unsuitable for growing growing crops for several years. And there's something called the Hayes famine in Iceland, which killed a lot of people, and it caused a massive famine in Iceland and neighboring lands. So around the sort of time period we're looking for Joseph, so if Joseph was historical, you can roughly do the genealogical calculations, and this is the sort of time we're looking for, about 1600, 1700 BC. There was a very massive volcanic eruption, one of the biggest in history, in 1628 BC. This caused very narrow tree rings for something like 6 or 7 years, and we can date it precisely from when these tree rings were, because tree rings are like annual rings in trees, so you can date when events happened. The technical term is dendrochronology. And so there was this huge volcanic eruption in 1628 BC. Ash from this volcanic eruption fell on Egypt, and so we know that Egypt was affected, and we found the ash for that. And the famine was also in neighboring countries, because ash fell in neighboring countries as well. And what's interesting about this volcanic eruption, if this was the cause of the famine in 1628 BC, we can ask, who were the Egyptian pharaohs at that time? And it turned out there was a period in Egyptian history, only of about 100 years, when foreigners conquered Egypt, and they had foreign pharaohs, and they were hated by the Egyptians. They were called the Hyksos pharaohs. So these are the Hyksos pharaohs, and we know their dates from Egyptian records, and they're about 1648 to 1540 BC. There were six pharaohs in this time period, and they were all foreigners. So this is rather interesting, because although I would agree it is inconceivable that an Egyptian pharaoh would appoint Joseph as their second in command, it is not unfeasible at all that a foreign pharaoh would appoint a foreigner as their second in command. So this now we can now say if Joseph did live at this time, and this was a time when you would expect there to be a massive famine in Egypt because this massive volcanic eruption, then this time was the time of these foreign pharaohs. So next slide, please. So these were foreign kings, as I say, hated by the Egyptians, and we know that from Egyptian records. And if we accept that the famine was due to this, and we can just do it tentatively maybe at the moment, this gives an absolute date for this event. And so if Joseph managed the food distribution during this time, he must have been Pharaoh's deputy in 1628 BC, which was the time of the Hyksos pharaohs. So it is totally plausible that the pharaoh would appoint Joseph as his deputy at this time. So the first criticism, which seems reasonable of many scholars, we can say, okay, if you look more closely, then it is indeed reasonable that if the Hyksos pharaohs were there, then Joseph could be appointed deputy. Right, next slide, please. And now let's have a look at the textual argument. And how do you date ancient texts? And it's quite difficult, but one of the ways to do it is that grammar and spelling does change over time. So if you pick up a book of Shakespeare plays, and you look at the language, you know it's not today's language, right? People don't write like that today. And so one way to date Shakespeare plays is to look at other written material which was written about that same time, and you go back in time, you find the language which fits. So you can date Shakespeare plays by just getting some other piece of literature you know the date of, which has the same sort of language and spelling as Shakespeare plays. So you can compare the language of existing texts of the Book of Genesis we have with that of other Hebrew texts whose dates are known, and so you can date the Genesis texts. It's actually extremely difficult to do because we have very few ancient Hebrew texts around that time. So the comparison is actually very limited, and it's difficult to do. But scholars have tried to do this. And one scholar that I trust is someone called Alan Millard, who's an emeritus professor from Liverpool University, who's a great expert in ancient Semitic languages. And he says that the Hebrew of the Genesis, the oldest Genesis texts that we have, the Hebrew of them in it corresponds to something like 700 to 600 BC, that sort of time. And many scholars would agree with that. So, right, so if Joseph was alive in 1628 BC, and we can date the language of Genesis text to 600, 700 BC, that is indeed about 1,000 years after the events recorded. So how can we believe that these texts really do say anything that we can take seriously about the Joseph story? So what we have then to realize is that this date that we've got is the language of the earliest Genesis text that we have, but these texts themselves are likely to be copies of earlier texts which have gone missing, and so they don't tell us when Genesis was originally written. So the original text is in fact lost, and what we have is scribal copies and copies of scribal copies. And next slide, please. So Moses traditionally is the author of the first five books of the Bible, and as people have pointed out, he can't be the author of all of them because they record his death. So he was an author, if you like, of the first five books of the Bible. This is the tradition. And I see no reason why he could not have been an author of Genesis. And this is now a quotation from Kenneth Kitchen, who's another emeritus Liverpool University professor, who's a great expert on ancient Egypt. And this is what he writes. He writes, "Consider Moses writing on papyrus or skins. Copies of originals will be recopied, modernizing outdated grammatical forms and spellings, a process universal in the ancient Near East. Experienced scribes were able to transmit very accurate copies of works for centuries." Now, what he says is really important for everyone to understand, and that is, he's saying, if you have a text which you may discover, which the language in it you can date to, say, 700 BC, an earlier text, 700 BC, that is not the language of an earlier text necessarily, because the scribes in updating would do everything very precisely, but they would update the language and the grammar. And it's a bit like modern Bibles, all right? You have a modern Bible, and it's not the language of the authorized version. Both claim to be accurate, but in the modern Bibles, the language is updated, all right? And so it's a similar situation with ancient texts. And if you go to the next slide, please, where I probably try and explain this more clearly. So, date of Shakespeare text. So, I've got a book at home, which has on the front cover, William Shakespeare, The Complete Works. And then if you open that inside, it says, thank you, it says, inside, Tudor edition, first published 1951. So, so we know that Shakespeare didn't write this in 1951. But what this means is that this was brought together, and an editor made some editorial changes, maybe, and clarifications. But he copied the writings and then edited them. And next slide, please. But we can find out when Shakespeare wrote his works by a couple of ways. One is dating the language he used, as I've said that before, and the other is trying to date Shakespeare himself. If you believe Shakespeare wrote this, which is sometimes debated, then you can go back genealogies and you can date Shakespeare himself. So we can find out when Shakespeare did this. It's a little more difficult with the Genesis text. Next slide, please. So let's suppose you're an archaeologist and you discover a text of Genesis in an ancient library, and you know this library is erected in 3 BC, for example, and then you look at the language in this text, and you say, the spelling and grammar, they're typical of Hebrew literature around 700 BC. And so you can say the text is 700 BC or later, but it may, and this is the key point, it may have been the revised text, updated in spelling and grammar, but otherwise faithfully copied of a much earlier original text. And what I'm suggesting here, it's not special pleading at all for Hebrew texts, because this is common practice, and there's lots of examples of Babylonian texts and Egyptian texts and there's Israel texts where the scribes, when they copied, they'd copy faithfully, but they would change, they'd update the spelling and they'd update the grammar so that they were readable to their present generation. And so the original lost text of Joseph's story may be very ancient, and we don't know how ancient it is. Next slide, please. So, well, now I highlighted in yellow the price of slaves. And what Kenneth Kitchen has done, and this is really interesting, he has gone into ancient literature, and it turns out that the price of slaves in Egypt and Babylon were very much the same, right, throughout the world. It's like buying a car now, it's much the same. And the other thing he found out is that it's subject to inflation. So you may remember if you bought a loaf of bread, 10 years ago, it was somewhat cheaper, and then it's a bit more expensive now, and it's going to be more expensive probably in, 10 years' time. So most items we buy, they get more and more expensive. All right, potato chips get more and more expensive. Silicon chips are an exception. They get cheaper and cheaper. But most things are subject to inflation, right? And what Kenneth Kitchen has shown, and this is really fascinating, I think, the price of a slave in the period 1700 to 1600 BC was 20 shekels of silver, right? And that's attested in various documents, we know that. If you go to 1400 to 1300 BC, the price goes up to 30 shekels of silver. In about 700 BC, it was 50 shekels of silver. 400 BC, 100 shekels of silver. And what the text tells us is Joseph was sold for 20 shekels of silver. So if this document was, if the original was, 1,000 years later, in 1,000 BC, then it would have used a higher... Let's say the 700 BC... documents that we have with that language in now, if it had been written in 700 BC, then they had no way of knowing that the price in 700 BC was 20 shekels of silver, right? So almost certainly they would have used the existing price for the price of slaves. And it's quite remarkable that the price they actually used is exactly the price you get if Joseph was at the time period of the Hyksos pharaohs. So, if you don't accept my arguments for a famine, if you accept that Joseph, this places him squarely in the time period of the Hyksos pharaohs, when it would not have been unusual at all for a foreign pharaoh to appoint a foreign deputy. So we have, I think, now a consistent story emerging, which suggests that the original story has been faithfully transmitted over a long period of time, and that it is a historical story. So we now move to the next topic, I think. No, all right, this is the summary. It's the story of Joseph historical. So we date Joseph to the time of these foreign Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt, and that's consistent with Joseph being made a deputy ruler. And then the text says he was sold as a slave for 20 shekels of silver, and we can show, and Kenneth Kitchen has done this, this was the known price of slaves in this particular 100-year period of time, after which the price went up. If the story had been invented later, the higher price in use would then have been used. So the Joseph story does have all the hallmarks of being historical, with the original text being faithfully copied by scribes who just updated the language and the grammar. And that's what we do with modern Bible translations. Right, let's move on to the next topic, crossing the River Jordan. Some of you, I think I might have talked about this as part of the Miracles of Exodus talk I gave in something like 2013. So I apologize if you heard this before. It's going to have a different slant on it this time. I'm not going to talk about the miracle at all. I'm going to talk about the history of this. So crossing the River Jordan is the last miracle of the Exodus story, and it's recorded in the book of Joshua. And next slide, please. And this is it, so I'll read it out to you. So the Jordan is in flood all during harvest, yet as soon as the priest who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarathon, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, which we call the Dead Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. Next slide, please. So this is the scene which is being described. The River Jordan isn't just flowing. Normally it's in flood. The Israelites are on one side. They want to be on the other side, which is their promised land of Canaan. And they've waited 40 years for this. Let me walk over to this side and look at this screen, then I can speak to people here a bit more. Waited 40 years for this, and tantalized they could see Canaan, but the situation looked hopeless because this flowing, rapid stream going, raging river going past, and then suddenly water stopped flowing, and the Israelites cross the riverbed in triumph, and then when they get across, the water starts flowing again. Next slide, please. So is the story historical? And most people in the past thought it was true, but most people today think it's a legend. And again, for a good reason. And the good reason is, our experience is that a river doesn't suddenly stop flowing, and then people cross it, and it suddenly starts flowing again. Right? It's totally against our experience. So people think it's a legend. It's actually a very logical thing to think. But let's explore this a bit further. So the River Jordan now is not very impressive. I don't know if some of you will have been to Israel or Jordan and seen the River Jordan, and it's sort of, I don't know, when I saw it, it was from this sort of music stand in width out to something where I am now, something like that. So not very impressive. So when I saw the River Jordan, I thought, well, you know, couldn't they swim across? What was wrong with them? What we have to realize is large quantities of water have been used for irrigation by both Israel and by Jordan. And so the River Jordan has almost dried up. So we told the Israelites crossed in the spring. They've told early on in Joshua the tenth day of the first month, which is the first month is the spring in the Jewish religious calendar. And the source of the Jordan is this snow-capped Mount Hermon. So in the spring, the snow melts and the river floods. And this is a photograph taken in the 19th century before all the water had been taken from the Jordan of what the Jordan looked like. So you can see it's just an enormous barrier. So it's not like the Jordan you see at all today. So that's what the Jordan looked like in flood. So this is something you wouldn't easily swim across, and the water's running very rapidly. And the next slide, please. There was a British expedition to Jordan in the 19th century, and they said the Jordan in flood was half a mile wide. Right, so that's the river you have to think of them crossing. This raging river, really wide, suddenly stops flowing, they cross, and then it suddenly starts flowing again. Next slide, please. So it sounds impossible, and can we know what happened 3,000 years ago? And most people, as I've said, and most biblical scholars believe the story is a legend, and that's not an unreasonable belief, but let's look deeper and look further. So next slide, please. So there is this strange detail in the story of where the miracle happened, and we have to ask with all these events, what did the writer intend, what does audience understand? And there is this detail. Let's just look at the story again. So the strange detail in the story is that the priests, their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing, but then the miracle didn't happen there, all right? The water didn't pile up by their feet where they were. It piled up in a heap a great distance away. So this is a really strange thing about the story. The miracle happened somewhere else, not where they were. And the writer actually then emphasizes it happened somewhere else. He tells you where it happened, at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarathon, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah was completely cut off. So this is the first curious thing about the story. And if the story had been invented, it's the sort of thing you don't invent. You know, if you're going to invent a story about the miracle, you have the miracle happening where the water piles up by their feet, so it's really dramatic. And here, it's a dramatic event, but the writer is saying, the water, you know, a miracle was somewhere else. It wasn't here, a long distance away. So it's a strange thing to say. And it sort of has a ring of truth about it in a way. So let's go to the next slide, please. So the writers in this story, but also in the Exodus story, in the book of Exodus and the book of Joshua, he's at pains to give detailed attention to the geography and the history. So he's trying to be historical here. There's no doubt that the writer means this to be historical. Next slide, please. So where was this place called Adam? And if you look on a modern map, you won't find it. And that's not surprising because after 3,000 years, most places have changed their name. A few names have kept, right? So Jericho was Jericho 3,000 years ago. It's Jericho today. But most place names, most places have either disappeared or their names have changed. And a modern example is what used to be called Bombay in India is now called Mumbai. So names keep changing even in recent times. So can we find out anything about Adam? Because we can't find it on a modern map. But when Hebrew names change to Arabic names, there are certain traditions which are kept. And the tradition is to keep the consonants, because Hebrew was a consonantal language. In the original Hebrew, there weren't vowels, there were just consonants. And when you read it, you had to put vowels in your brain. Or when you read it out loud, you had to put vowel sounds in. Okay, just yeah. Okay, it's fine. Thank you. But the original Hebrew for Adam was just the Hebrew for D and Hebrew for M. And when modern Arabic words replace the ancient Hebrew, they usually keep these consonants, but they may change the vowels and they may change the ending. So we look on a modern map of the state of Jordan for a town with the letters DM in it. And there is a place, and that's modern Damia, which is on the east side of Jordan, 17 miles north of Jericho. And in fact, I put most scholars, but I think all scholars now agree, that I've read, ancient Adam is now modern Damia. So we know where ancient Adam was. It's changed its name to modern Damia. And the next slide, please. So this shows you on a map where... Okay, I am red colorblind, so I'm not seeing this, so I won't wave it around. So you can see on this map that the Israelites came up on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, and you can see where Jericho is on this map. That's where they crossed opposite Jericho. And then you can see maybe about 20 miles upstream, there's this place called Adam, which is modern Damia. And Damia can be spelled different ways. They spell it as they pronounce it. So this tells you the geography of the situation, and Anad Adam is certainly a significant distance upstream. Next slide, please. So this is where the science comes in. So July 11th, 1927, there was an earthquake which shook Jericho. Buildings collapsed and walls cracked. It was detected around the world, in Europe, USA, Russia. It was 6.5 on the Richter scale. There was an earthquake in New Zealand, many of you will remember, which killed 200 people in Christchurch, and that was 6.3 on the Richter scale, so you know, really quite similar magnitude. So this earthquake in 1927 was a major earthquake, and it's due to slippage along what's called the Jericho Fault, and this is a fault which runs north-south under the River Jordan. And the next slide, please. Okay. Let's have the next slide, just in case there's a map there. Okay, let's go back, because I omitted the map. But you can think of the River Jordan, right, running down sort of north-south. And on one side of it, there's a tectonic plate. And on the other side, there's a tectonic plate. And these plates are moving like this. So there's a sort of shear movement. But they're also moving apart as well. So it's quite complicated. And opposite Jericho, there are some sub-faults, which actually just run towards Jericho from these faults. And so that's why you get lots of earthquakes in this region, because of these tectonic faults. And I wrote to Professor Neuer, who studied this in some detail. He's a professor at Stanford University. And he wrote back to me, and I said, can I quote you? He said, of course you can quote me, so I'm quoting him here. So he said, during the 1927 earthquake, several ground cracks appeared, together with an outpouring of groundwater. This soil liquefaction phenomenon has been well observed in earthquakes elsewhere. During the earthquake, mudslides occurred along the Jordan near Damia, so that's ancient Adam, about 30 kilometers, 18 miles north of Jericho. These temporarily stopped the river's flow. And next slide, please. And this is a photograph of an earthquake-induced mudslide in 1957, which almost stopped the river's flow. So you can see what's happening. So the river's just easily flown around this. But if it's a bigger mudslide, you can see the river would be stopped, and then it has to come over the top of the mud or divert around it. And that takes typically 1 to 2 days. And next slide, please. And his message continues. He says, Adam is now Damia, so he's sure that the site of the 1927 mudslides, which cut off the flow of the Jordan. Such cutoffs, lasting typically 1 to 2 days, have also been recorded in 1906, 1834, 1546, 1534, 1267, and 1160. And then the records stop. But you might think they actually go back to the time of Joshua. The stoppage of the Jordan is so typical of earthquakes in this region that little doubt can be left of the reality of such events in Joshua's time. Next slide, please. So we now ask, is this crossing of the Jordan story a historical story? And what we find is that the story of the River Jordan stopping, then starting again some hours later or 1 to 2 days later, is far from being impossible, as people suppose, because it's happened many times. And it's owing to this earthquake-induced mudslide in the region. So this is just consistent with the book of Joshua saying the water piled up in a heap. It did. It piled up in a heap behind this earthquake-induced mudslide. And then the location of this heap, we're told, was not nearby, as expected, if this story had been invented, if it was a legend. but it happens at a great distance away at a town called Adam. And that's precisely where these mudslides have occurred a number of times, like 10 times in recorded history. So I believe this is really strong evidence that this story is historical, right? It's not a myth, it is historical. So this is the second example of a biblical story which many scholars think is a myth, and where when you look into it in more detail, there's actually a lot of evidence that this is what happened at the time of Joshua. So next slide, please. Let me look at my watch and look at the time. Right, okay. So the historicity of the gospel. So I'll be quite brief here because I want to save some time for questions. The gospels, you know, four gospels, and what they do, they essentially give us four portraits of Jesus. So if you think of painters painting a person, and you think of painters painting a person from a different angle and from different distances maybe, then you have four different portraits when you have four painters, but to get a more complete picture, you put them all together. And that's what we try to do with the Gospels. Each Gospel gives a different view of the life of Jesus, but you put them together and you get a more complete view of the life of Jesus. Next slide, please. But this is a... We've asked the question, are the Gospels factual? And a number of scholars, this is Geza Vermesh, who is an Oxford scholar who died a few years ago, who I knew quite well. He says this is a book he wrote, The Passion. It was a Penguin book. It actually sold extremely well. And then he writes, the four Gospels are neither simple or coherent. On the contrary, they are filled with discrepancies. And that's what a number of modern scholars believe. And the question is, though, or a question I ask this, is are we failing to understand the Gospels because of our lack of knowledge of life in Jerusalem in the first century AD? Because you have to think, you have to read the Gospels in their first century AD context. And so a key question is, do the four Gospels agree? And next slide, please. And what I've done is to, and I'll just go through this very briefly, I've tried to look at what is called the biggest of these discrepancies, right? The biggest problem in the New Testament Gospels. And a great scholar called F.F. Bruce described this as the thorniest problem in the New Testament. This is the problem of the Last Supper. We'll say what it is in a moment. And then this is an evangelical scholar, Dick France, who wrote a commentary on the Gospel of Mark, and he says that the debate has been extremely complex and the issue remains unresolved. So let's see if we can throw some light on this issue, but let's tell you what the issue is. And this really is thought to be the most difficult problem in the New Testament, where Gospels appear to contradict themselves. So just before we do that, let's remind ourselves what Passover is. So the Jewish feast of Passover, the Passover lambs were slaughtered, Josephus tells us this, in the afternoon of Nisan 14. Nisan is the first Jewish religious month of the year, and 14 is the 14th day of this first Jewish month of the year, and it corresponds to our March or April. It usually spans across March or April. And the Passover meal, so the lambs are slaughtered on Nisan 14 in the afternoon. The Passover meal started at sunset that evening, and the Jews had a sunset to sunset day, so it was at the start of the next day when they had their Passover meal in Nisan 15. And it was actually full moon time, because the Jewish first day of the Jewish lunar month is the crescent moon, and so 14 or 15th day of the month is a full moon time. Next slide, please. So this is a Last Supper problem. The Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which are often called the synoptic gospels because they're broadly similar, they describe the Last Supper as a Passover meal, and they do that very clearly. And John's gospel, I think equally clearly, says it was before the Passover meal. And because of this, you get two different dates for the crucifixion, one on Nisan 14, one on Nisan 15. And it is a particular puzzle because you may think the gospel may have minor errors, but here's the Last Supper meal, and Jewish people would never mistake whether a meal was a Passover meal or not. So it really is, you know, it is the major problem, most scholars say, in the New Testament. Not only that, there are witnesses. I mean, all 12 disciples we know at the Last Supper, and so they would have known if it's a Passover meal, and they would have told the writers of the Gospels. The writers of the Gospels would have spoken to them and said, was it a Passover meal? So it is very strange, strange apparent contradiction we get at least in the Gospels. So next slide, please. So this is what Mark's Gospel says about the Last Supper. Mark has the disciples asking Jesus, where do you want for us to prepare the Passover? So they call it the Passover. And as Jesus is eating the meal, in Luke's gospel, he says, I've eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. So Jesus says it's a Passover meal. So according to the synoptics, the Last Supper is a Passover meal which was held on the evening of Nisan 15 with the crucifixion later that Jewish day, still on Nisan 15. So this was held in the evening, and evening to evening day. The next slide, please. This is what John's gospel says. John introduces the Last Supper by saying it was just before the Passover feast. So he is very specific. And the evening meal was being served. And then later on in John's gospel, after they've had their Last Supper and Jesus is on trial, John says, the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas, the palace of the Roman governor, to avoid ceremonial uncleanness. The Jews did not enter the palace. They wanted to be able to eat the Passover, right? So they hadn't yet eaten the Passover. And so John, in fact, has the Last Supper before the Passover meal. And John actually has a crucifixion on Nisan 14, a day earlier than the synoptics, apparently. This is Nisan 14 when the Passover lambs are being slain. So next slide, please. So I've thought about this quite a bit over a number of years. I was on holiday some time ago, maybe 10 years ago, in Greece. And so I was in this country and went to church on Easter Sunday here, and then went to the Greek island of Crete. And I thought, gosh, they're celebrating Easter on a different day, a week later. And then I thought, well, I know this because the Orthodox churches celebrate Easter on a different day from the Protestant and Catholic churches. So why is that? And it's a calendrical reason. So that you go back in time, they used to all celebrate Easter on the same day. So they had the same formula. But then Pope Gregory had what was called the Gregorian calendar reform, and he changed the Julian calendar, which everyone used, to the Gregorian calendar, because the Julian calendar was getting out of step with the sun. So this change made sense to do this. Protestants and Catholics, Protestants gradually did this. They adopted a Gregorian calendar, so that the Protestants and Catholics all use a Gregorian calendar today to celebrate their Easter. But the Orthodox Christians said, in our tradition, we've always used a Julian calendar, and we're not going to change, right? So the Orthodox people in Russia and Ethiopia and so on, and Greece, they used the Gregorian calendar. They changed for their everyday life, but for their religious festivals, they said, we're sticking to the Julian calendar. And that's why the dates of Easter are different for the Orthodox Church and for Protestants and Catholics. So I wondered if the same explanation could be the reason for John's Gospel and the Synoptics being different. So I looked into this, and there's significant evidence that this is the case. Next slide, please. So the question is, did Matthew, Mark, and Luke describe the Last Supper using a different calendar from John? And in particular, did John use the official Jewish calendar, which had been used in the first century AD, in which the Last Supper was before the Passover meal? But did Jesus choose to use an earlier Jewish calendar in which the Last Supper was a real Passover meal as described by the synoptics? Matthew, Mark, and Luke describing this meal according to an earlier Jewish calendar in which the Last Supper would be a real Passover meal? And is John using the official later Jewish calendar in which the Last Supper was before the Passover meal? So next slide, please. And I don't have time to go through the details now, so I'm just going to give you just a few outline slides. When did the official Jewish calendar start? There's a lot of evidence it started when the Judean Jews were taken into exile in Babylon in this sort of time period. And the Jews, in fact, adopted the Babylonian, they were probably forced to adopt it when they were in exile, they adopted the Babylonian calendar. And they took over Babylonian names for months. So the first Babylonian month of the year is called Nisanu, and the Jews just shortened it to Nisan. So there's significant evidence that that's when the Jewish calendar that was used in the first century AD, and indeed what is used now, was established in about the period 596 to 537 BC. So what calendar did they use before? And next slide, please. And so what calendar in particular did Moses used to celebrate his first Passover when the Jews were in Egypt. And the Egyptians had two calendars. They had a solar calendar for business and so on, what they put it, civil purposes for business. And they had a lunar calendar for religious festivals. And this lunar calendar started in 3000 BC. It's one of the oldest calendars in the world. And so it's not unreasonable that Moses was using the Egyptian lunar calendar, because again, they're in Egypt forced to use their calendars. But what the book of Exodus says is, this month will be for you the first month of the year. So God is actually saying, use the calendar you've got at the moment and just change the first month. And so what I suppose was Moses used the Egyptian lunar calendar with the first month shifted to Passover time. And then in my book, I give evidence that the Samaritans have used this calendar essentially, and they never change. When the Judean Jews changed their calendar after the exile, the Samaritans didn't. So there's a different calendar. Next slide, please. And this pre-exilic calendar, which was based on the Egyptian lunar calendar, persisted down to the first century AD. And there's evidence that various Jewish groups used it, the Samaritans, the Zealots, some of the Essenes, and some of the Galileans. Of course, Jesus was a Galilean Jew as well. So it wouldn't have been particularly unusual for Jesus to choose to use this calendar to celebrate his Last Supper as a Passover meal. Next slide, please. Yep, next slide, please. So the Synoptic Gospels are telling us that Jesus chose to use the original Passover calendar of Moses, this pre-exilic calendar. And why should Jesus want to do that? Because it was then on the exact anniversary of the first Passover of Moses. They were using the same calendar. And Jesus was identifying himself as a new Moses. And he said, I've come to give you a new covenant, for example. So it made a lot of symbolic sense for Jesus to do this. And next slide, please. So key conclusions. I've raced through this a bit. The Gospel accounts last week of Jesus I find to be in remarkable agreement. So where Geza Vermesh and others say there's huge discrepancies, I simply don't find these. If you look in detail, if you have a knowledge of ancient calendars, I just find they're not these discrepancies. They're in remarkable agreement. And we have used science and the Bible to work to solve, you know, this thorniest problem in the New Testament. Next slide, please. If you want further details, I'm not trying to sell my book. I've said borrow it from a library. That's a good thing to do. It gets it into libraries. But if you're interested in more details, then more details are given in this book. Next slide, please. And so this is the last slide, I think. So I've left time for some questions. So we've used science to show that the story of Joseph in Genesis, the crossing of the River Jordan in the book of Joshua, the details of the last week of Jesus in the Gospels, I hope I've shown they're all likely to be historical. Next slide, please. And there are many other examples I could have given. So I could have talked about the order of the plagues of Egypt, which I think were a series of natural events, which are special natural events, which God was working through nature to achieve these events. But once one plague just leads to another, which is I talk about in a book called The Miracles of Exodus. And if you just reverse two of these plagues, the whole sequence breaks down. So these 10 plagues have been transmitted, I believe, in the correct order, as well as being, you know, correct plagues. Because if you interchange two of them, the sequence breaks down. Or I could have talked about the Star of Bethlehem, which I've talked to before. I could have talked about the long day of Joshua, which is, I think, astonishing evidence, again, for something which is historical. So there's lots of examples you can give. And so I think this gives us confidence that the... This gives us confidence the Bible is a truly historical record, I believe, of the development of Israel and of the birth, death, and resurrection of Jesus. So let me finish there, and there's time for some questions. Right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Colin. And we've got about 15 minutes. If anyone would like any questions.
Have you converted anyone by your science?
Have I converted anyone by my science? Yes, some people, I think, have I mean, I'll tell you a partial conversion then. And this is, I wrote this book called The Miracles of Exodus, and I had a Jewish person write to me afterwards, and I think he obviously thought I was a Jew from what he said. And he said he had been a Jew, because he just thought the whole Exodus story was unbelievable. And I convinced him it was believable, so he started going to the synagogue again. So,
can I ask you a small pedantic question?
Yes.
Over here?
Yes.
How did Joshua manage to see 18 miles up the river Jordan to Adam?
Right. That's a very good question. So I think that the Israelites were curious people, as we were, and I think the river stopped. And it wasn't stopping where they were. And so I think Joshua sent some people. He said, go upstream and see what's happening. You know, why is this river stopping? It's a sort of reaction we might have. And that's why they came back and said, look, we found this this great landslide, this place called Adam. And so, you know, that's why it's got recorded. So I think that's what happened.
Okay, then.
Right.
Numerical relationships.
Right.
Have you found anything with that?
Right. So.
Have you gone deeper into the numeracy of the Bible?
Right. So I think.
And reoccurring themes like the 7 keeps occurring a lot. Yeah. The 14 keeps coming up.
Right.
The 28 comes up.
Right.
The 40 comes up.
Yes.
144,000. Right. How does? Do you not ever take away the numbers, the 3 days, 3 periods of 24, 72 hours?
Mm.
Do you not take away these periods and work with these numbers ever and look at the relationships with the numbers and just take the numbers as a pure number?
Right. Well, no, thank you. That's a good question. So certain numbers in the Bible do appear much more frequently than other numbers, like the number 3 or number 7 or number 40. And so when I see these numbers, then I think they can be literal numbers, or they can be like figures of speech. You know, they're used a lot. And so, and we do the same today. We'll say, I'll see you in a month's time, but you don't necessarily mean in exactly a month's time, you say about a month's time. So people, when people talk about 7 days, it means about 7 days, or 40 days, maybe about 40 days. And 40 years can often mean a generation, which in practice was less than 40 years, but you know, it's a sort of maximum time for a generation. So I think numbers in the Bible are very interesting, and you know, that's the way I interpret them. Sometimes literally, you have to look at them and see how the writer meant them to be interpreted.
I thought of doing a book on that.
Right, thank you. No, I haven't, but yes, yes. Maybe you thought about doing this. And, yes, yes.
You seem to have all the answers. So.
Right. No, I don't have all the answers. No, thank you. Yes.
The Star of Bethlehem, what conclusion have you come to that could have been? You said that you solved that problem.
Well,
too.
I've worked on that problem, right. Yes. So I think the Star of Bethlehem was a comet for 3 main reasons. One is, if you look at the account in Matthew's second gospel, then there are 3 descriptions of this star you can pick out, and it's sort of a layman's description of the star, but Herod asked the Magi the exact time the star appeared, so this means, you know, before that time it wasn't there, and after that time it was there, and a comet is one of the stars which can do that, right? It's coming in from, you know, from a long way away, and then the naked eye suddenly sees it. So it's a newly appeared star. The second thing that you can deduce from Matthew's gospel is that the star travels slowly through the sky against the normal star background, because when the Magi first saw the comet, they said, well, first saw the star, they said, we saw it in the east, and so it's to the east of them. And then when they're in Jerusalem and they went to Bethlehem to find Jesus, they said they saw the star in front of them, and Bethlehem is due south of Jerusalem. So the idea is this star travels slowly through the sky, which is what a comet does. It does this about 1 to 2 degrees a day. And the third thing, which I think is the fingerprint of it being a comet, is this very curious phrase in Matthew that the star stood over the place where the child was born. And so you say, how can a star stand over a place? And it's not possible with any star apart from a comet, because if this comet has a very long tail, and we haven't seen a comet, and I haven't seen one in my lifetime, but there are woodcuts and photos of long-tailed comets which have appeared in the past. So you have a comet with a head and a very long tail going up like this, and it appears to point, the long tail appears to point the head of the comet actually towards a particular city or even a particular building. And there are woodcuts showing this and drawings showing this in the past. So that's the only star, I think, which can appear to stand over a place. So I think a comet just satisfies the description in Matthew's Gospel. Yeah. And that was in 5 BC. It's recorded in Chinese records of the time, and they thought this was a remarkable comet.
First of all, thank you for a great talk.
Thank you.
You know, reinforces the faith to hear what you're talking about. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, some of the future events the Bible talks about? I'm thinking about maybe the Book of Revelation. Mm. You know, any thoughts at all on that?
Right. Okay. So, we have to be quite careful talking about prophecy. And the Book of Revelation is about the future, and I think scholars are divided about how much of it was the sort of near future for John, who was writing this, and how much is a far future. But I will say something which struck me this year. So in the Book of Revelation, there's something called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which some of you may be familiar with. And I think the first horseman, the rider, has a bow, and some people interpret that as a warrior. And, you know, bows are fairly long range, so, you know, minor wars may be starting. And then I think the second horseman, oh, I probably won't get it right, the second horseman is a fiery red horseman, that's right, and the rider has a giant sword, right? So this suggests a rather major war. And then the third horseman, oh, famine, that's right, thank you. Famine, so the third horseman has these scales, and he says something like a quarter wheat for a denarius or something. But this, anyway, this is 10 times, we know the price of wheat at that time, it's 10 times the normal price. It's a quarter wheat for a day's wages, that's right. And day's wages were typically by 10 quarts of wheat, so it's you know, a huge price, and that's because there's a great famine. And then after all this, it says that there's going to be a quarter of the world which is destroyed by famine, war, and pestilence, which is plague. And why this I thought was quite striking just recently is that Stephen Hawking, in just May of this year, has a television program in which he says the human race is likely to die out this century, and we better populate some other planets if we want to keep going. And it's going to die out because of war and famine and pestilence. He didn't call it pestilence, but basically antibiotic resistant, you know, superbugs. And then another a very well-known astronomer called Martin Rees, who's a Cambridge astronomer, he is, I think, still the Astronomer Royal. He wrote a book a few years ago called Our Final Century, in which he says this century there's a 50-50 chance the human race will just be exterminated, just die out. And he gave the same sort of causes, which was massive famine. So he linked it to global warming. Global warming causing massive famines and superbugs and the other things. So there's actually, you know, there's actually these two very, very famous scientists and Revelation sort of coming together in what they're commenting. So I leave that thought with you. Yes. Right,
yes. Thank you.
Professor, are there any examples of biblical accounts which you have studied but for which you have not been able to find a scientific explanation and which have led you to conclude that those accounts are indeed mythical?
Right, well, thank you, sir. I will now, what's the time? I'll now talk about this long day of Joshua. So I was here, I think maybe the first talk I gave here, where someone in the audience, they said to me, what about the long day of Joshua? And I said, I'm sorry, I really don't know, right? And for those who don't know, the long day of Joshua is in the book of Joshua, and it's after the crossing of Jordan, they're in Land of Canaan, and Joshua prays to God, and he says, and I'm not remembering this exactly, but he says something like, O son, stop in Gibeon and O moon, stop in the valley of Adullam, and that sort of thing. And then we read that the sun stopped and the moon stopped, and we read that the day was extended, and the Israelites could beat their enemies. And this is a particular problem for anyone, I think, but for scientists in particular, because when we think of the sun going around the Earth, what's actually happening is the Earth is spinning on its axis, right? So that's why the sun appears to go around the Earth. And so if the sun stops, then the Earth stops spinning on its axis. And that causes all sorts of problems. I mean, I'm not sure if people in Australia would fall off, but, it causes all sorts of problems. And so it's very hard to say what this means. And so I would have said, for some years, I just don't know what this is. But recently, literally in the last few months, I have come up with some explanation. Would you like to hear the explanation? Right. So, the explanation is that the Hebrew does indeed say the sun stopped, the moon stopped. But what all biblical translations, starting with the King James Bible and going on to all of them today, what they all assume, the translations assume, is that this means the sun stopped moving. And there is another interpretation which occurred to me, and that is, could the Hebrew mean the sun stopped doing what it normally does, and that is stop shining? Well, do you want to say something? Yes. Say something. Exactly. Thank you very much. That's right. So the sun stopped shining. So I checked this out with Alan Millard, who's a great Hebrew expert. He said, that's really possible interpretation. And he said, by the way, you're not the first person to think of this, right? And it turns out that someone called Wilson at Princeton University thought of this about 100 years ago. And not only did he say it could be a solar eclipse, he actually went further than that. He said the root of the Hebrew word that is used for stopped is the same word used in Babylonian cuneiform texts to describe eclipses. So it's a direct link to eclipses, right? So that's quite striking. And then about 50 years ago, quite a well-known astronomer did calculations of total eclipses visible from Canaan. And he said, in the period 1500 BC to 1000 BC, so he used a huge time period, there were just two total eclipses visible from Canaan. And he said what the dates were. And the problem is that those dates are both really too late for Joshua, right? And so this eclipse story just disappeared because of that. People saw, look, the facts don't fit, this interpretation, it's a lovely interpretation, the facts don't fit. And then I had an idea, this isn't now my idea, and that is I knew that in the modern world, we have separate words for a total eclipse, an annular eclipse, and a partial eclipse. And an annular eclipse is when the moon does blot out the sun, but it's a bit closer to the sun than normal, and so you just get a tiny ring of the sunlight coming through. And so in the ancient world, they didn't distinguish between total eclipses and annular eclipses. So the Chinese, for example, had one word for a partial eclipse, and the other word covered both annular and total eclipses. And so I then worked with an astronomer colleague, and we calculated annual eclipses, and in this period, 1500 BC to 1000 BC, there is one annual eclipse which was visible from Canaan. In fact, it goes right across the center of Canaan, and that date is extremely suitable for Joshua to have been there and seen. And so I'd written this up, and I thought I'd publish it to start with an astronomy journal because I want this verified by astronomers. If you try and publish in a biblical journal, they'll say, but it's a science, right? So if you publish it, I've got it accepted by an astronomy journal. And what's interesting about this is that if you accept this, it's really interesting because it gives you an absolute date for the entry of Joshua into Canaan. Right, because if you look at Joshua text, the crossing of the Jordan seemed to occur just a few months before this eclipse observation. So you have the actual year he went in, and that gives you a handle on the date of the Exodus. You go about 40 years before that to get the date of the Exodus. And then the other thing of interest is that the son of Ramesses II called Meneptah. And it was Meneptah has a stele, which is an engraved granite block, which is now in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. And that says in his fifth year, he made various conquests, and one was the people's... Right, this was erected in his fifth year. He said in the first 5 years, he conquered the people of Israel who were in Canaan. So we know that the Israel was in Canaan at that time of Meneptah. And this is... and you can... You can say when he did do this conquering of Israel to within a year or so, and that enables you to get a date for Meneptah and also a date for Ramesses II, who was his father, and I think it enables you to refine their dates and probably get the most accurate dates in Egyptology, which is one of the claims of the paper. So it has all sorts of interesting consequences. So it turns out to be a very interesting story. So I say, if there's things I don't understand, I say... There's such a lot which has been shown to me to be historical. If I don't understand them, I think maybe one day we'll understand them. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you very much, you. Colin, for that. And just a little token of gratitude.
You're very kind. Thank you. Thank you very thank much. You. Right. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you very much. Thank you.